Today we're going to continue what we started last week, which was entitled The Mystery of the Wise Men from the East. So we looked at the fact that we are all familiar, most of us are familiar with the song We Three Kings. That may not be the name of it, but that's what I can recollect from my time singing that particular piece. And we looked at that and saw, and we also looked at the concept of the three wise men and some other things associated with that. And you may have thought, well, what else are you going to cover? There's actually more that I think you'll find interesting, and hopefully it'll be profitable for you. So as I said, we talked about the wise men from the East who came into Jerusalem to worship the one who had been born king of the Jews. And when these wise men arrived in Jerusalem to find out about the one born king of the Jews, at that time he was no longer a baby, he was not in a manger, but he was living in a house with his mother and father. Also, we learned in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, that the wise men and their accompanying army upon entering Jerusalem caused Herod to be in fear. It says that he was troubled. Well, if you look at what it says there, he was actually in fear. And not only was Herod in fear, but so were the people of Jerusalem. And they were fearful because of who these people were and because of the number of people that had come into the city. It wasn't three. Three wouldn't have mattered because the population of Jerusalem at that time was about 50,000 regularly. So when you have three people come into a city of 30,000, it doesn't matter. So anyway, there was fear on Herod's part. Because he feared that there was something more significant going on than them just coming to find out about the one who had been born king of the Jews. We also discussed that the only nation from which they probably could have come would have been Parthia. It talks about them being from the east, and if you look at Jerusalem, what empire was directly east of Jerusalem? And it was the Parthian Empire. And that empire began at the Euphrates River and carried all the way over to where China was at that time. So it was a massive empire that was a rival to the Roman Empire in size. In fact, it was a little bit bigger. So the Parthian Empire and the Roman Empire shared a common border. That was the Euphrates River. And, you know, if you look at a map and look at where Babylon is, the Euphrates River runs through the city of Babylon, and it was the border between the Roman Empire and Parthia. So we concluded last week that the Parthians the wise men from the east were in fact Parthians. They were Parthians from that particular empire. And if you look into them more deeply, they were most probably Jews and or Israelites. They were Jews and or Israelites. And because they had some knowledge of the scriptures and the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9 in the Old Testament scroll. So they were aware of this. And when God brought their attention to the fact that the Messiah had been born and work began to sent that the angel to them, which they followed all the way to Jerusalem and led them to where Christ was at the time. They had some knowledge of the scriptures and they could see it all fitting together and therefore were willing to make that trip. Remember, the Jews had been in Babylon for 70 years prior to being free to return to the land of promise. So they had been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, and they had been forced to leave their land, and Nebuchadnezzar moved them north and east to Babylon and areas surrounding. So the Jews were already in residence in Babylon and the surrounding areas by the time this is taking place. They had been there since the time when they had been carried away captive. For instance, Daniel was carried away captive in about 605. And we'll talk about that more in the Bible study. But they had been in Babylon for 70 years, and then they were, it worked out for them to be able to return to the land of promise, and we'll discuss more details about that in the Bible study. So these people who were living near Babylon and the surrounding areas and were part of the Parthian Empire had continued to worship God in Babylon and the Persian Empire as well. You know, they had worshiped through the Persian period, the Persians had fallen, and now the Parthians had come on the scene, and they were in power. And that's just a quick summary of how it all worked out. But when you think about the Jews continuing to worship God, that makes sense, because if you look at the book of Esther, you had the Jews living in that part of the world, Babylon and other cities and territories, and they continued to worship God. And as you look at the people of Judah returning to the land of promise, only a small portion of them made the trip back to their homeland. They were free to do so, but they didn't return, most of them, because they had homes, they had businesses, they were free to worship there. And so why are you going to make that trip back to where you were from? You know, once you had been uprooted from your homeland and moved up north and east, you become, this is where I live. And they did not all want to go back. It was a unique group that wanted to go back. They wanted to go back to the land that God had given to them and to set up the kingdom of Judah once again. So let's think about a few questions here. Why would the wise men from the east want to bestow great treasure upon the one who was the king of the Jews? For instance, it talks about them bringing gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And those weren't just little boxes of those particular spices or the gold. They were extremely valuable, each one of them, and there was a large quantity of them. Now, why would they bring what you could actually call a treasure with them to the land of Judea? Why would they bring that to honor the king of the Jews? We'll think about and answer, what kind of government structure did Parthia have? And think about, how did the Parthians select their king? And you think, well, what does this have to do with anything for me? And I think you'll find it interesting what it has to do with you and me. We're going to answer, who was their king and what title did they bestow upon that king? What was his title? He was a Parthian king, but what was his title? And why were they so interested in the one who was born king of the Jews? So these are just a few of the questions that we're going to answer in this second sermon on the mystery of the wise men of the East. And this is the second part of that. As you go back and you look at the Parthians had established an empire. And as we look at things, we look at it from the Greek and the Roman point of view. And the predominant power in the world at the time of Christ's birth was Rome. And for them, you know, as they looked at history, who was the greatest general? Well, for the Romans and the Greeks, it would have been Alexander the Great. And yes, he was an impressive conqueror, but he was not the greatest. Others would contend that somebody by the name of Mithridates was actually the greatest of conqueror. He was a Parthian king who extended the empire to the furthest extent that the empire had. He ruled between 165 and 132 BC. And the writer, Charles Rawlinson, contends that he was actually the greatest conqueror of territory among human beings around that time. During his reign, Parthia was transformed from a small kingdom into a major political power in the ancient East. It was a political power that was a rival to Rome. You remember last time we talked about Crassus wanting to conquer Parthia. They were a rival, and he figured, if we can conquer the Parthians, we can extend our empire even further east, and we'll have power, and we'll have more wealth, and we'll know what to do with. So I'd like to now clarify further who these Parthians were and why history has largely overlooked them. And let's think about that in terms of who specifically did Christ say he was sent to minister to? Who specifically did Christ say he was sent to minister to? The answer to that is found in Matthew chapter 15, verse 21. Matthew chapter 15, verse 21. So Christ came, and God the Father sent him into this world, and one of his missions was to minister to a certain group of people. Matthew chapter 15, verse 21. Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." But he answered the woman and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So who did Christ commission his disciples to go to? So keep that in mind. Christ was sent to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So who did Christ send his disciples to? Let's look at Matthew chapter 10, verse 5. Matthew chapter 10, verse 5. There it says, "These 12, that is those who became the apostles, Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, 'Do not go into the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter the city of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.'" So he said, don't go into the way of the Gentiles or the Samaritans. And that's not that God had no intention of teaching them or sharing the truth with them. It was just a matter of timing. And they would have their opportunity. And as we'll find out, Paul was the one who had the chief responsibility of going to the Gentiles. So Christ's instruction to his apostles raised two questions. And why is that? Because one, how could the apostles go to the people that God directed them to go to if they didn't know where they were? If they were lost, how would they know where they were at? The second question is, if they knew where they were, how could they be lost? You know, if they knew, they weren't lost. So the question is answered by understanding what the word lost means. And it's translated lost, but you could translate it a little bit different, which would give us greater clarity. The Greek word translated lost is spelled A-P-O-L-L-U-M-I, apolomi, and found in Strong's. And it could be translated lost, but it could also be translated destroy, or lose, or mar, or cause to perish. Another lexicon or Vines says the following: it talks about law to be lost or that which is lost, and metaphorically from the relation between shepherd and the flock. So Israel became separated in truth, from God because of the way that they were living. They didn't live in a way that honored God and respected God, so they drew away from him, and God allowed them to be punished as a result and allowed them to be carried away captive. And the kingdom of Israel was destroyed when the Assyrians came in and carried them away captive, and the same thing took place with Judah. The Babylonians came in, destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and carried away the people of Judah. And these these conquests did not happen all at once. With the Assyrians, it came in several stages, and with the Babylonians, it came in three different stages, where they conquered them initially, then the Jews rebelled, and so they came in again and took some of them away, and then the final conquest in 586 with the destruction of Jerusalem. So to put what Christ said in a more understandable form, you might say they were really the destroyed sheep of the house of Israel. Israel's homeland had been destroyed and taken over by the Assyrians. Their homeland had perished in the sense that it was no longer in the possession of Israel. That land was no longer theirs. They had lost their homeland and had been deported to other parts of the earth, and they were forced to either remain captives in Assyria or to continue, as they had the opportunity, to migrate to other areas north and east of Israel. When ancient Israel was conquered by the Assyrians, everything they had previously possessed and was destroyed. And at the time of the destruction of the nation, Israel actually numbered in the millions. So you have these people carted away, and there was actually a substantial number of them. And yes, a lot of them had died in the conquest and in being forced to leave their homes, but a large number of them survived, both Israelites and Jews. And one of the things we have to realize is, even though they were taken away, they did not die out. They weren't destroyed. They ceased to exist as a people. They didn't occupy their homeland, but they continued to exist. You see that with both Israel and Judah. Let's go to the book of Hosea, chapter 1, verse 1. Hosea, chapter 1, verse 1, and we can see what the prophet Hosea has to tell us about God allowing Israel to fall. Hosea, chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, the king of Israel. So at the point that Hosea is speaking, Israel was still in the land. They had not been conquered yet. Hosea 1, verse 2. When the Lord began to speak by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry, for the land has committed great harlotry by departing from the Lord." So you have not honored the covenant, you have not remained faithful, and as a result of that, you are going to suffer the consequences. So, chapter 1, verse 3. So he went, and so this is speaking of Hosea. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to him, "Call his name Jezreel, for in a little while I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu, and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." So he's telling them, the result of your lack of fidelity to the covenant is going to result in your being carried away captive. And you're going to be overrun and taken captive, and your bow, your armaments, and all of the things in which you put confidence in is going to be broken in the valley of Jezreel. Verse 6, and she conceived again and bore a daughter. Then God said to him, "Call her name Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take him away." And that's what happened to the people of Israel. And the same thing happened to the Jews as they were carried away captive by the Babylonians. But even after the house of Israel was destroyed and taken away from their homeland, they continued to exist, they continued to multiply, they continued to have children and to exist. They didn't disappear from the face of the earth. They had not been destroyed. Let's look at Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. There it says, "Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea." So this is a prophecy that tells us, even though Israel was carried away captive, they weren't going to cease to exist. But God was going to bless them as they moved away, and they suffered the consequences of their kingdom being destroyed, but God was going to allow them to multiply and to grow in numbers like the sand of the sea. Like he said, it's like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said of them, "You are not my people," there it shall be said of them, "You are our sons of the living God." So God punished them. God took them away, but God didn't just cast them away forever. I mean, that's something that not only happened historically, but God pointed out to the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, where he talked about that he has not cast Israel away forever. So even after Israel went into captivity, Israel continued to increase and multiply in number, and they weren't in their own land, but they continued to exist and continued to multiply. Israel, it says, would be scattered among various nations, and they would be wanderers. You look at Hosea chapter 9, verse 17. Hosea chapter 9, verse 17. There it says, "My God will cast them away because they did not obey him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations." So they were uprooted from their homeland. They were moved north and east, the Israel up into the territory of the Assyrians, and later on the people of Judah were moved up in the area of Babylon and further eastward. But they continued to exist. And the Israelites may not have known a whole lot about who they were because they had already begun losing that while they were in the land. But they had some inkling of that, and the Jews never did lose an understanding of who they were, because they continued to worship God in the land of Babylon. We see that, and we know that from what we read in, as I said, in the book of Esther, and as you look at the interchange between the land of Judah and the people in Babylon in Ezekiel's time, where there was communication going back and forth, and you have Daniel there, and there's communication going back and forth. Now, that ceased once the complete conquest took place by the Babylonians, and they carried them away captive. But they were moved out of the land, and they began to become wanderers among the nations. So God would punish them, but that punishment wouldn't last forever. Look at what it says in Hosea chapter 14, beginning in verse 4. Hosea chapter 14, beginning in verse 4. There it says, "I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from him." So God doesn't punish forever, and God allowed them to, began to show them favor and allowed them to begin to grow in numbers. And it says, "I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall grow like the lily and lengthen his roots like Lebanon. His branches shall spread. His beauty shall be like an olive tree and his fragrance like Lebanon. Those who dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall be revived like grain and grow like a vine. Their scent shall be like the wine of Lebanon." So God eventually is going to bless them once again. That's true not only back in ancient times here, but that's something that is yet future as we look at the world in which we live now. After Israel's final fall to Assyria, many fled to what became known as the Scythian Empire, which was north of the area of Babylon. It was an empire that existed there, which began to form around the time Assyria was invading and overwhelming Israel. The Scyths, S-C-Y-T-H-S, historians refer to them as descendants of Isaac, sons of Isaac. And it's interesting as you look at the word Scyth and you think about the Scots, they seem to be pretty close in the way that they're written. The Scythians were named after the sons of Isaac. And this is a reference to the sons of Isaac or to the sons of Israel. And then the Scythian Empire flourished from 700 BC to 400 BC when it was conquered by a people called the Sarmatians. And so the Scythian Empire fell, and after they fell, then the Parthian Empire began to rise. And we see that Christ said that he came to go to the house of the lost sheep of Israel, and he sent his disciples to them as well. So if he's sending them out, and Christ came to them, so he lived among the descendants that he was to address, and he was going to send his apostles out, so it would only make sense if they knew where in the world they were. So the question is, did they know? Did they know where the people that God was addressing were actually at? Let's look at the fact that we can see a bit of this as we look at the letter that the Apostle Peter wrote. And as you look at the letter, ask yourself, did he know where the house of Israel was? Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. So here, the Apostle Peter, one of the apostles that Christ sent out as his servant to represent him. He was a herald of the kingdom of God. And to whom did Peter go? 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 12. There it says, by Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God in which you stand. She who is in Babylon, and he's not talking about that figuratively, he's talking about that literally. She who is in Babylon, and he's talking about the church that had been established in Babylon. She who is in Babylon, elect together with you. The elect are God's people. The elect are God's people. Elect together with you greets you, and so does Mark, my son. So Peter is sending a greeting in his epistle from Babylon. And Peter, who wrote the letter from Babylon, at his greeting indicates that there were other Christians there as well. They were sent out, just like Paul, to establish churches. And they went out to all of these places in Parthia, north, east, south, and west, and they raised up churches as God blessed them and blessed their efforts. Let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and look at verses 1 and 2. 1 Peter chapter 1 and look at verses 1 and 2. And take note of the places that it talks about here. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 2. It says, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the pilgrims of the dispersion. So the dispersion took place when the Jews were conquered by the Babylonians, and it had taken place before then when the Assyrians conquered the people of Israel, and they carried them away, and the people were dispersed. The people were dispersed. And so they spread out, and we find that they were in Pontus, they were in Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. These are all places in Asia Minor, but they were dispersed to those locations, and Peter is writing from Babylon. So there were obviously people there that had become a part of the church in Babylon, and I'm sure if there was a church in Babylon that it spread from there to other parts of the Parthian Empire. He says, elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father in sanctification of the Spirit for obedience and sprinkling of the blood of Christ. So these are people who God has called out and added to the church, just like the people in Jerusalem or the people in Rome or the people in Galatia. These were all people who had become a part of the church that God was beginning to work with and were the fruit that was born through the preaching of the apostles. So Peter had been commissioned to go to the lost house of Israel, and we find Peter was acting on Christ's commission. So we find him in Babylon, and we find that Paul went out carrying out the same mission, but he went to the Gentiles. But as you look at the record in the book of Acts, he not only went to the Gentiles, he also went to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He would go to them first, wouldn't he? Until they rejected him. But he would give it a shot, talking to them, and if they rejected him, then he would move on and work with the Gentiles. So as you think about it, which empire was Babylon in at the time of the apostles and Jesus Christ? Which empire was that city in? It was in Parthia. It was in Parthia. We don't often think of that, but that's the reality. They lived east of the Euphrates River, which was Parthian territory. On the day of Pentecost, it's interesting as you look at the people who showed up in Jerusalem at that time. Look at the people who showed up there. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 5. This is instructive. And it tells you that these people were aware of God's truth. They knew about the Feast of Pentecost, and they showed up for the Feast of Pentecost. Acts chapter 2, verse 5. It says, "And there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when this sound occurred," that is the sound of the trumpet and the blowing wind, "and when this sound occurred, the multitude came together and were confused, because everyone heard them speak in his own language." So this is a miracle of hearing and speaking. "And they were all amazed and marveled, saying to one another, 'Look, are not all those who speak, they're all Galileans, and yet when I hear them speaking, they're speaking in my tongue.' And what tongues were they hearing and speaking in?" It says it begins with "Parthians and Medes and Elamites, those dwelling in Mesopotamia." Mesopotamia is, Babylon and those areas around there. So you have Parthians, Medes, and Elamites, these people who had come up to Jerusalem, and these people were hearing, seeing something spectacular take place. Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and parts of Libya adjoining Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs. We hear from them speaking in our own tongues the wonderful works of God. So they are all amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, "Whatever could this mean?" And it was God sharing the truth to them in a spectacular way, and the church, as a result, was beginning. So these people heard the truth and responded to the truth, and what did they do? Did they stay in Jerusalem? They did maybe for a time, because something spectacular had stayed there, and they saw it develop, but then they moved back home. They went back home to where they were from and shared that truth with other people. Look at what the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus had to add. And you might ask, did Flavius Josephus know about the 10 tribes? Did he know where they were in his time, which was around the time of Christ? Many came to Babylon, he's talking about Israelites who were very desirous of going down to Jerusalem. And they came up to Jerusalem, and Josephus was well aware of that. And Josephus records the remainder of the 10 tribes, he said, are beyond Euphrates until now. So they're east of the Euphrates River. And what area was east of the Euphrates River? It was Parthia. They are an immense multitude and not to be estimated by number. So Josephus indicates Israel had already become an immense multitude, which we've already talked about as a prophetic fulfillment. The only empire beyond Euphrates was Parthia at the time of Jesus Christ, Josephus, and the apostles. So we have historical confirmation that the 10 tribes of Israel were a vast multitude living in the Parthian Empire. Now, we don't often think of that, but that's the reality of the time. At the time of Jesus Christ, the Parthian Empire had incorporated a large portion of the descendants of the house of Israel into its population. And Christ knew where they were, the apostles knew where they were, and went to them to fulfill the commission Christ had given them. Interesting look at what James chapter 1 tells us. James chapter 1, verse 1. Christ's own brother, what did he know? He shares that as he begins his letter, James chapter 1, verse 1. And there James says, James, a bondservant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. So a number of people knew of the house of Israel being in the Parthian Empire. So you might ask, who then were the wise men from the east specifically? And why did they have an interest in the Messiah? Why did they want to bring him gifts of great value, treasure, really, of great value? We know they offered these gifts to the Messiah as representatives of the Parthian Empire. So these wise men were Parthians. They were people of stature in the Parthian Empire. They were called Magi, which was a Parthian priest, and would have been one of the highest offices in that empire. They were high officials in the Parthian Empire who had made their way to Jerusalem to honor Jesus Christ. And since they were priests, they were probably descendants of the Levites. And as you think about, just think about this. This is a little bit of history that Charles Rawlinson recorded in his Ancient History, Volume 2. And he was talking about a Parthian general, and when he would travel, what kind of retinue would he have? What kind of retinue would he have? And it's just interesting how he traveled. And so as you think about that, think about these wise men from the east. In the ancient history that Charles Rawlinson wrote on in volume 2 and page 284, it talks about a Parthian general named Cyrena. That general was actually the one who defeated the Romans as they invaded the Parthian Empire, which we read about last time. And when he traveled, he always had 1,000 camels to carry his baggage, 200 chariots for his companions to carry their baggage, and for his guard, 1,000 horses, completely armed, besides a great number of light armored troops, which did amount to less than 10,000 men. So that's a pretty substantial group of people. Many of us would call it an army. So this account is from about 52 BC, 50 years before the birth of Christ. So would it be surprising that such a large retinue would show up in Jerusalem if they were traveling from Parthia into the land, the Roman territory? I mean, you're entering enemy territory. You know, you've defeated the Romans, so the Romans definitely aren't pleased with that. And seeing this large group of men and horses all armed coming into your territory, that may have been seen as provocative. And as you look at the way Herod responded and the people of Jerusalem, they felt maybe it was provocative. That's why they were afraid. So the question for King Herod and the city of Jerusalem was, why are they coming? Why are they coming? What are they doing here, which they did not understand? So why did God inspire them to come westward into the land of promise? Why did God inspire that? So they came to honor the one who was born King of the Jews. And back at the time of Christ, what did they expect Christ as the King of the Jews to do when he returned? What did they expect? What did the disciples expect? Look at Acts chapter 1, verse 6. Acts chapter 1, verse 6. What did the apostles expect to happen? So Acts chapter 1 tells us, therefore, when they had come together, they asked him, that is, they spoke to Christ and asked him, saying, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel? They knew prophetically that that was to take place. And they're wondering, is this going to happen now? Are you going to restore the kingdom of David, which is predicted biblically? Are you going to restore that now? You are the son of David. Are you going to do this right now? And so that's what they were expecting that. And wondered if it was going to happen. They expected the glories of David's kingdom to be reestablished. The Christ is here. They accepted that. So are you going to do this now? And Christ had to tell them, not yet. That's for a future date, but not now. So what relationship, if any, did Christ have in regard to the king of Parthia? What does Christ have to do with the king of Parthia? And interestingly, as we'll see, Christ did have a direct relationship to the king of Parthia. And as you think about that, and you think about Christ as a king, did he, Christ, have the right to the throne of Parthia? Did Christ have a right to the throne of Parthia? And just a little bit of background here to help us understand about the government in Parthia. Parthia had what is called a constitutional monarchy. A constitutional monarchy, they were ruled by an elected king. They were ruled by an elected king. They were elected by a vote of two houses of parliament, their legislature, and Parthia was ruled by a dynasty of elected kings. They did not pass the rulership of a king from father to son. That's not how it worked. The kings of Parthia were elected. And any male relative of the deceased king could be chosen or elected as the new king if he met the criteria, but he had to meet certain qualifications. So what were the qualifications? The one condition that all the elected kings of Parthia had to have, for the king to be chosen or elected, they had to be from the house of Arasid. What does that mean? Doesn't mean anything to me or you. It's just a name. But that they had to come from that particular house. To be of that house meant this. They had to be a descendant of King David. They had to be a descendant of King David through the Perez line of Judah. So you think, well, what in the world does that mean? Well, if you go back to Genesis chapter 38, it talks about two lines that were descended from Judah. They were born to Tamar, and there were two sons born, and they represented two lines who were descendants of Judah. Let's just read about that in Genesis chapter 38, verse 27. Genesis chapter 28, verse 37. In Genesis chapter, or it's not 28, but Genesis 38, verse 27. It said, now it came to pass at the time of giving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was, when she was giving birth, that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was Zerah. So you have these two twin sons that were born. One was Perez, and one that was called Zerah. And let's look at prophecy concerning these two boys and their descendants, Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 17. This is speaking of David and his kingdom and his being king and what God promised to him. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 17. So the kings of the of Parthia had to come from one of these lines of kings that went all the way back to Judah. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 17, it says, "For thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel." So this was a promise that God gave to the descendants of David in Jeremiah chapter 33. David was already dead. But the promise is being made that he's never going to lack someone to reign on the throne of the house of Israel. Never. So that means during the entire time of the history of this world, there's always going to be someone, someplace that is a descendant of David. Verse 18, it says, "Nor shall the priest, the Levites, lack a man to offer burnt offerings before me, to kindle grain offerings to sacrifice continually." Now, he may not be serving in the capacity of a priest in a temple, but the descendants still exist. They still exist. Jeremiah 33, verse 20. And it lays out here in verse 20 how ironclad this promise is. Jeremiah 33, verse 20. "Thus says the Lord, if you can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that there will be no day nor night in their season," well, if you don't have day or night, once that goes, then sure, this prophecy can be no longer applicable. But God said, as long as the sun and the moon rise and that all is taking place, then you can count on this promise being fulfilled. So he's saying that my covenant may also be, was not, if that can happen, no sun, no moon, no regular cycle, then my covenant may also be broken with David, my servant, so that he shall not have a son to reign on his throne with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. And as far as I know, the sun's still rising and setting. The moon still comes and goes and is in the regular orbit. So I would think that this is still applicable. At the time of Christ, this prophecy was still being fulfilled. A descendant of David was still king of Parthia. And they knew that he had to be a descendant of Judah. And the caste of priests were descended from the Levites. Let's now go to Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1, which continues this story. And this is about the genealogy of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 1. And let's pick up the story in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. There it says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. And Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar." Perez begot Hezron, and then he goes on and talks about these others that were born. Goes on to talk about Salmon begetting Boaz by Rahab. And Boaz begot Obed by Ruth. And Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David the king. So it goes through this genealogy and is pointing out that Jesus is descended, both Mary and Joseph were descended from this line of kings. Mary was by blood a descendant. Joseph was by right. He wasn't descended from the kings by blood, but he was a descendant of that line. So David the king begot Solomon by her, and he had who had been a wife of Uriah. And then it talks about in Matthew chapter 1, verse 16, about Jacob begot Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Joseph. So the legal genealogy of Christ came through Joseph, even though he was not a blood relative. And basically what's happening here is we look at what Matthew writes. It's substantiating that Christ had the legal right to be king of Parthia. He was a descendant of David through the Pharez line. Think about it. Here's Parthia. The greatest empire in the world at the time was the Parthian Empire. They had defeated the Romans on the field of battle, and Christ had a right to that throne. The wise men came to Judea, having recognized that the one born king of the Jews was the Messiah, and they came to offer him kingship in Parthia. And you think about, you know, we kind of think about the treasure that they brought to honor Christ, that it's three little boxes of something or other. But you have to realize that you've got camels in this caravan, you've got horses, and you've got ways to convey a lot of treasure if you want to. And that's what they brought in honor of Jesus Christ. Now, what did they expect? They expected that Christ would be the King of Kings. And they were bringing this treasure to give to the King of Kings in order that the kingdom could be set up. And guess who else was aware of that? Did Satan offer the kingdom to Christ? He most certainly did. He offered him the kingdoms of the world because they were his to give. And it was a legitimate offer. You can be King of Kings if you'll just bow down and worship me. However, that's not going to last very long, because once you die, it's over. And Christ knew there's a bigger plan here. I'm not going to take this offer because it's not going to be of benefit to all humanity. From the time that Jesus Christ was a child, he knew he was born to be a king. And he could have taken that offer from Satan. He could have taken the wealth that was brought to him by these kings from the east and could have used it to form an army and to conquer and to rule as King of Kings earlier. But that wasn't God's plan. That's not what he and the Father had worked out. So Christ said, no, I'm not going to do that. He told Satan in Matthew chapter 4, verse 10, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. And then the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and ministered to him. And Christ turned down a very real opportunity to become King of Kings early, much earlier, because, you know, 2,000 years have passed since this time. But let's go back to the end of the book. Let's go back to the book of Revelation and look at a couple of scriptures here as we come to the end of this sermon. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19 and look at verse 16. And this is speaking about Christ as he has returned and taken his position as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And let's look at what it tells us in Revelation chapter 19, verse 16. This is speaking about Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and it says, he has on his robe and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Well, that's referring to Christ. But consider what the title for the Parthian king was. What was he called? Their title for their king was, and this particular title was written on the Parthian king's robe, it was King of Kings and Lord of Lords. King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he had that title because he was a descendant of David. And they knew that a descendant of David would one day rule as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What was the difference between this robe and the robe of the Parthian king? It's a significant difference. Christ's robe was dipped in blood, because Christ is not only to be King of Kings, he's our Savior. So his robe is dipped in blood because he is the Savior of the world, laying down his life in order that we can be forgiven of our sins and live forever. So Christ chose to live and die for the sins of mankind before becoming King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That's yet to come. It's promised. We can count on it. In Daniel, one final reference here. If you look at Daniel, he talks about the fact that in chapter 7, verse 27, it says, "Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." That's yet to come. And in Revelation chapter 17, verse 14, speaking about Christ one final time, "These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful." That kingdom is yet to come, and Christ is going to assume the throne of that kingdom as King of kings and Lord of lords. So as you look at this story, hopefully it gives you a better understanding of the wise men from the east. The story that we're commonly given is that this is this song, and there's not much to it. But as you look at history, look at it historically, there is quite a story to it. Hopefully you found it helpful. So hopefully this solves the mystery of the wise men from the east, and I hope that you now better understand and the significance of those wise men and how that's all going to play out in the future. So thank you for your attention.